The problem is you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking, conversations with experts exploring all things psychology.
Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name is Nesh Nikolic, and my guest today is Dr. Susie Green. As a clinical psychologist with extensive experience in the treatment of mental illness, Dr. Green is on a mission to reduce the impact of mental illness in our workplaces, schools, and communities, and promote the value of improving mental wellness. Dr. Green is the CEO and founder of the Positivity Institute, an organization dedicated to the research and application of positive psychology in workplaces and schools. Dr. Green is an honorary professor in the School of Psychology at the University of East London and holds honorary academic positions at the Centre for Positive Psychology, University of Melbourne, and the Black Dog Institute. Dr. Green is also an affiliate of the Institute for Wellbeing at Cambridge University. It's a great pleasure to speak with Dr. Green on the topic of enhancing mental health outcomes in organisations and schools through positive psychology and focusing toward promoting mental well-being rather than mental illness alone. Enjoy. Susie, a big thank you for coming onto the show today. It's exciting to talk about mental health so openly and freely these days, with stigma having changed immensely over the last 10 to 15 years, and in particular looking at how we can improve mental health difficulties or reduce the challenges that people are experiencing in all spaces of life, being workplace, schools, communities, and alike. So thank you and appreciate you coming onto the show.
Absolutely. No, it's my pleasure to be here. And yes, it is exciting times to be working in this field right now, Nesh.
I know that you've been in this space for quite some time. Maybe I can start with asking you how the landscape has changed from your experience. What have you seen over the years?
Yeah, I think I was quite fortunate when I started my clinical master's, which translated into a clinical doctorate. There was still quite a lot of stigma around talking about mental ill health in the workplace, in the community more broadly. And a series of fortunate events, ended up doing a doctorate on evidence-based coaching as a mental health prevention intervention. So, which was quite abnormal at the time in and of itself, Nesh, when I first took my research idea, you know, as a poster, and the head of the clinical department was walking around looking at all the, you know, the research proposals, and there's depression and anxiety and schizophrenia, and there's my life coaching studies in there. And of course that was poo-pooed in the initial instance. And I was very fortunate to have Professor Lindsay Oades, who's now down at the University of Melbourne, as my doctoral supervisor, who really went into bat for me to say that our role as clin psychs is not just treatment. We have a significant role in prevention and promotion. And so, to cut a long story short, I ended up doing this coaching study, which then propelled me into the world of coaching psychology, which, for those that don't know, it's something I'm very proud of. Here in Australia, we have the world's first coaching psychology unit at the University of Sydney. And coaching psychology as a field is now global. And in fact, the British Psychological Society now have a division, a dedicated division, like we have colleges. So it's come a long way. And yes, but I think in the early days, I was at the University of Wollongong, and we used to have an Institute for Mental Health. And I used to sort of think at the time, it's not mental health, it's actually mental ill health. They're studying mental ill health. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but because I was focusing on that prevention, that promotion piece, I started to move pretty rapidly into what can we do proactively to reduce mental ill health and promote well-being, which at the same time, so if you think about it, I was doing that 2001 to 2003, positive psychology as a field emerged around 1998. And so I've sort of grown up with these two complementary fields of positive psych and coaching psych over the last 20 years. And look, I worked clinically for a number of years after my doctorate, I would say maybe another 5 or so years, but I then transitioned into coaching, which is where I retain a handful of senior exec coaching clients. But I'm grateful for my clinical degree every single day, Nesh, particularly at this time when there are a lot of well-being consultants out there, many without much training or adequate mental health training, I would argue. So I'm very, fortunate that I did, knuckle down. And we all know that those of us that have done a clinical master's or doctorate, how challenging it is, that I got through that because I use those clinical skills. Even though I'm not using them with clinical clients, I'm definitely still using them in my practice as a coach and in my, educational programs that I provide to the community and in workplaces and in schools.
Can you talk a little bit about that overlap and I suppose also difference between the focus on improving mental illness versus the focus of mental well-being? It sounds like some might think there's quite a lot of overlap. Others might see a stark difference. It's interesting to hear what that difference is for you, because obviously that was something that was quite prominent for you. And I know for myself, for example, thinking about my university time, I was really wanting to do my topic on the use of language and how it moderates psychological interventions. And interestingly, if I look at where I've landed in the ACT space, that comes from relational frame theory, which is so fascinating that the language component was there early on, and I didn't know why I was so attracted to the ACT framework and understanding that these relational frames are language models and understanding how we connect those. So it would be interesting to hear, how do you see that space between, mental well-being, promoting that being the focus, versus the other side as, looking at mental illness?
Yeah, I think, I'm hopeful that education for clinical psychs has evolved. I can't actually speak to that because I haven't been in that world for a while. But when I was doing my training, it was very deficit focused. It was very symptom focused. It was very, intervention focused, specifically, as I said, focusing on symptom reduction. And I think because I moved into coaching psychology because it was part of my doctorate, I started to take more of a holistic approach to people's lives then, rather than just purely look to treat, a symptom of depression or anxiety, for example. I, like you, Nesh, I attended one of the first ACT courses here in Australia back when that first started, would have been 2005 or six or something like that. And I'd already started in my coaching practice, and the approach that I'd been trained in through Sydney University and Professor Tony Grant and the coaching psychology unit was very values-based. And that was new. I'd never, I was trained in primarily cognitive behavioral therapy. I was very fortunate to do, I was involved in a research project on brief supportive psychodynamic psychotherapy. So I was very fortunate. Plus I worked in a psychiatric clinic at the time. So, and my husband at the time, ex-husband now, but was a psychiatrist. So I also had a lot of the flavors of psychoanalytic psychodynamic psychotherapy. So I feel very privileged for that. So when I went to that course on ACT and they started to talk about values, I thought, I'm already using values. Like in the 2 or 3 years before it was introduced to me from Tony Grant. And when you're coaching someone, he always used to say, start with what's important to them, what matters most to them in their life. And so for me, it's very, I've aligned quite closely too with ACT and the values component. But I think, for me, I then moved pretty quickly into working with people, looking at their whole life, looking at their values, looking at their dreams and desires for the future, not just, I'll work with you until your scores on the DAS are down in the normal category, And I think Marty Seligman, who many people will know, is identified as the founding father of positive psychology. It actually was Maslow that coined the term before that, but Marty sort of brought it back up and certainly took it out to the public a lot more broadly. But Marty always used to say, you know, it's our job as psychologists historically, particularly in clinical or counselling, has been to take people from minus five to zero and then say bye-bye. Or like in my case, once I've got someone into normal on the DAS, bye-bye. But really, the coaching and the post-psych is more about how do we enhance somebody's well-being. And, you know, with recognition that the World Health Organization also recognizes that mental health or well-being is more than just the reduction of mental ill health. So I was very fortunate to move into, okay, but what can we do to actually take it up another level? And even in 2001, there was about 30 years of research, primarily by Professor Ed Diener, on subjective well-being. So that was pre-existing. And I was able to, in my coaching study, utilize his measure of subjective well-being, which includes the satisfaction with life scale and the PANAS, the positive affect, negative affect scale. But I also, in my research, and then I took through to my practice, I was referring to Professor Carol Rift's work on psychological well-being, which is a much broader conception, eudaimonic. So they differentiate in the study of happiness or well-being more broadly, which is my preference, subjective, which is hedonic well-being, more shorter-term pleasure, satisfaction, versus eudaimonic, coming from Aristotle originally, and this sense of living in accordance with one's true self, and I guess more a sense of meaning and purpose. So Carol Rift's model, and it's still very relevant today for those that are interested. Again, it's used in research, her assessment, but the model of these six scales of positive relationships with others, autonomy, which fits with a lot of self-determination theory research, purpose in life, you know, so it's a much broader conceptualization. So I actually started to, even in my clinical session, started to, I guess, inquire with clients around these different aspects of life for them. Or I'd, as a case conceptualization, you know, even with my supervisor, start to look at them through a much broader lens rather than let's just get the symptoms down, you know, reduce the symptoms.
It's so fascinating how psychology can come at a problem in so many different ways, but it really resonates with me about the difference between symptom reduction versus looking at life functionality, human desires, you know, who and what is important, that values-based approach, and also understanding one's own capacity to overcome challenges so that they can step towards or lean into those things that are most important and that we're going to take with us for forever. And so I've always looked at, you know, how do we apply psychology not only to those who are suffering most and are most acute, I suppose, or even in that severe moderate stage, all the way through to how important is it for the community to have people who are living well and the affect that they have on them, you know? And a classic example is when someone's going through a tough time, there are often carers, either a carer or carers around them, that is really a scaffolding that the community doesn't see, you know, and they are the mums, they are the dads, they are the siblings, they are the friends, they are the people in the physical roles as well, the health providers. But how important is it for all of them not only to go from minus five themselves to zero, but in actual fact, be at five themselves or 10 themselves? And because there's a ripple effect, we all appreciate and understand the value of that. So I like that model in that, you know, positive psychology and to even think about, you know, what's ahead of symptom reduction. And symptom reduction is nice, don't get me wrong. We all prefer to be more comfortable. At the same time, you know, resilience comes from having experienced lots of challenges and difficulties and, you know, obviously a particular mindset too. But I like that. It resonates for me what you've said.
Yeah, absolutely. I think too, Nesh, some of the skills, well, I can give you a wonderful example actually. I was attending a conference in Kansas. It was actually on instructional coaching, which are teachers that utilize a coaching approach to improve instruction in the classroom. And I was a keynote speaker there on coaching. It's probably 2010. And there was an academic presenting, Professor Peter Clough, on mental toughness. Now, I had prior to that had conducted a research study with senior high school students utilizing a measure of cognitive hardiness, which had been existing for a number of years. And I'm trying to think of the authors' names. There's a couple of different authors that created that tool. And it consists of challenge, control, and commitment. There were three C's in the original cognitive hardiness measure, MADI, Salvatore MADI. And anyway, Professor Peter Clough, he's a sports psychologist. And so he's presenting on this new construct of mental toughness. So I thought, oh, this will be interesting. You know, I'll go along and have a listen. And he basically presented his model, which he was very well researched and validated, based on the original cognitive hardiness of challenge, control, and commitment. But he brought in a fourth C, being confidence, which was related to a lot of the research on self-efficacy, again, pre-existing. Anyway, it really resonated with me because I already knew the model and then I knew the self-efficacy research. And so I thought, this is such a great model to help people understand. And whilst there is some nuances and differences between mental toughness and resilience, which I can talk to if there's interest there, but he started to talk about what can we do to develop mental toughness. And he starts listing off interventions like anxiety management, visualization techniques, mindset techniques. And I'm sitting there, you know, again, as a clin psych going, I used all of these techniques with my clinical clients, you know, particularly my anxiety clients. I did a lot of, you know, imaginal desensitization, exposure response therapy. So all of these different types of interventions that he was using had come out of sports psychology, because he was a sports psych and he was using these same techniques with elite athletes. And I had this amazing sort of epiphany or aha at the time that, you know, if you're lucky enough to be an elite athlete, you had access to some of these psychological skills, you know, or if you had a good sports coach, and not all sports coaches even to this day have these skills, not all of them. Or, and I say this tongue in cheek because we'll all know it's not wonderful if you're in a state of distress to go and consult with a clin psych. But if you were fortunate enough to have been and seen a clin psych or a psychologist more generally, you might have learned these skills also, you know, the same, whether it was cognitive behavioral act, mindset skills. So there's performance there. I'm thinking of the model that the mental toughness is. It's around performance thinking, visualization, anxiety management, attentional control activities, goal setting and coaching. And so I started to visualize the bell curve and I'm thinking, right, you're down here on of mental ill health through to well-being. You're in the clinical realm. You'll be learning these skills, which, as we all know, you have for life once you've learnt them, if you keep using them, and they can then prevent further illness. Or if you're fortunate enough to be up here in elite, whether it's sports or as I moved into senior executive coaching, you know, those same skills that I took from a clinical degree, I was using in executive coaching with senior executives for performance. You know, so it's just had the same skills, but how you were using them. But then I realized this, you know, the significant amount of people in the bell curve in our community, in our society, in our workplaces have never had access to these skills, generally speaking. Like they've never been taken out. And I think, you know, another epiphany for me was, Nesh, when I started learning, I was only an intern psych and I'm learning some CBT at uni, and my children were in primary school at the time, and I thought, these are such great skills. Like, why aren't my kids learning these skills at school? And so that was another big aha for me, that we need to get this out more broadly into the community. And look, I know we do need more longitudinal studies. It's difficult to do that. And I've had people say, you know, we don't have the research to show that teaching these skills is going to prevent mental ill health. Well, no, maybe we don't know that, but why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you give some of these basic psychological capability skills that we learn? As I said, you learn them reactively after you're not doing that well, or if you're fortunate, a privilege to get them up the other end. It just to me was, and I think the other thing, Nesh, even though the research probably, you know, even to today doesn't give us a lot of support for that, I guess, preventative or promotion, there is definitely some, but when you've sat with somebody like you have and other people listening to this today as a clinician, and you can see that some of these skills are life-changing for people, like, why wouldn't you take them out? And will everybody benefit immediately? No, maybe not. They wouldn't. But and that's why I think I moved into working in education. I had a, you know, an opportunity to do some research in that field, and I became very passionate about that. So for me, it's let's try and get some of the skills into schools, which of course is now happening.
And I think it's such an important approach for psychologists, and I think all health professionals, to think about is health promotion, you know, as being such an important factor of societal improvements. And yes, we can argue, you know, what's the research that shows it. Truth be told, the research is done as you go along. So all interventions, a large proportion of interventions should start with a pilot program as an example, and we measure it. And if it has merit and value, then we go out and we expand it. We don't want to be sending, you know, tens of millions of dollars down the drain, but we can certainly do so where we might take a small pocket of a community, trial it and test it and see if have we moved the needle. And then by virtue of doing so, we can go out and demonstrate that the research is there. But to go out and say, don't try, is kind of ridiculous. You need to go out and do these trials. And I think in most situations, we will see some improvement. How much that is, I don't know. But we should continue to try and apply what is the next best thing. So any trial that comes out and, you know, is replicatable and demonstrates a higher movement of the needle, let that one supersede the other one, and around we go until we've got psychs or extremely well trained mental health professionals going to schools, for example, or workplaces, and having these conversations so that people either are given a brand new tool that they've never observed, yeah, or they could say, hey, I have been doing that, and now I'm going to actively repeat doing that because it actually has merit and it reinforces that response.
You do see that a lot, Nesh, where people have that recognition. Oh, I have been using this, but I didn't know that there was, you know, 30 years of research behind it, say, for example. But, you know, even with something like CBT, which I know, you know, that there are different people have different preferences, whether it's ACT or CBT or combination. But when you're working in that space, and you have been for a long time, I think you can forget just how powerful some of these techniques can be, because I have spent a large majority of my career in the corporate sector. And even to this day, you're working with very intelligent people, and they honestly will have an aha around, oh, never thought that I could think about it that way before, or look at it that way, or, you know, and just some of these base skills that we would take as basic skills to teach clients can have such a, like, just basic. I spent the first part of my career in the psychiatric clinic. I was working teaching anxiety clients, you know, abdominal breathing techniques and progressive muscle relaxation. And it's really been wonderful to see, you know, a new wave of that coming through, you know, particularly through social media and a lot of, you know, Huberman and a lot of the other people on social media platforms that have got a big platform. But, you know, I've been using that. It changed my life when I learned that in my 20s, basic abdominal breathing techniques and progressive muscle relaxation. And I think now with the use of technology, so I have people in workshops that say, yeah, I've been doing some of that breathing. I had to make a stressful call the other day. I practiced the breathing, I looked at my heart rate, and then, you know, I was right to make that call. So that's really, to me, I think that's wonderful that we're seeing I'm trying to think of who the author might have been. When I did my doctorate, there was an author, psychological author, that spoke about giving away psychology, the giving away. And, you know, if you think again, if we go right back, some of the historical that, you know, the analyst or the therapist, you know, kept the notes and wasn't very open about their theories or their hypotheses and or their techniques or whatever. And, you know, in the spirit of giving it away, like, how do we help? Particularly, I think they'll all, at least in our lifetime, there will always be a job for us. But, you know, if we can help reduce the burden of mental ill health in our society by equipping people with some basic psychological skills, to me, that's very important that we get that information and skills out into the community.
I think it's also important that we're given an opportunity to do so over time. There's a very, very big difference between doing a 1 hour presentation at a school versus being able to attend a school on a regular basis, because the nuances are where all the juice is. You know, I know in therapy myself, and I'm sure you've experienced the same, from my perspective, being an ACT therapist, I might introduce the concept of diffusion with a client. And by the time the client returns for the following session, they're using words like "it worked." And that immediately tells me that they've flipped diffusion to become a symptom reduction strategy, rather than the philosophy that underpins it, which is being the observer and reducing the power of thoughts. But they require ongoing support and being able to observe that. And likewise, I think interventions are important, that when we do deliver them, whether it be in workplaces and schools and the like, should really be gauged at a time period in which we can work, so that we have an opportunity to reinforce learnings, to take away some of the myths that have maybe happened unintentionally, and so on. And that's an important part that I don't think we're there yet within the community. We do have wonderful schools and we do have wonderful organizations saying, come on in, do a talk. But yes, I'm a bit dubious in terms of, could we do more by many more follow-ups? So it's more of a program of exploration rather than we will do the intervention and then you use the strategy and therefore that is good. I'm not quite convinced that we're there yet, but that's also exciting because it says we've got a pathway forward that psychology can promote, you know, more cultivation of psychology in the school or psychology in the workplace.
You're so right. It's one of my concerns too. We also know, like, on stats around, you know, retention or, you know, transfer of training, like there's about three or four key studies that people retain less than 10% from a workshop. That's always my concern. I try to integrate at the very least some coaching conversations. So certainly not trying to train people to be coaches by any means, but give them, suggest to them or recommend that they set up a coaching buddy or co-coach or a accountability buddy or something, and that the organization tries to create some structures or some space, because right now, and this has certainly been the case since COVID, when organizations are just throwing, I would call it, mental health and well-being information at people, and they have big platforms, and I say to them, you know, what's your mental health and well-being strategy? Oh, you know, we've got a platform people can access. But I say to them, okay, where is the space? Where in their day is there a space for, number one, reflection, and number two, on perhaps, you know, going and spending some time seeking or looking for this information? So I did a blog on LinkedIn, if anyone's interested, on wellbeing information overload. Like, it's just, and it's also now being called in the wellbeing world, I guess in the workplace, wellbeing washing. You know, we've heard this term green washing in terms of organizations just ticking a box around sustainability, and we're starting to see that in workplaces now. I'm fortunate in as much as I, you know, I've been in this field for a while, and so I've noticed just even the beginning of this year that we have organizations coming to us saying, can you help us review our well-being strategy? That in and of itself is an issue too, because we now have, as you may be aware, we now have legislation in every state of Australia around psychological health and safety. And so organisations have got legal obligations, and part of that obligation is to mitigate risk. So there's a recognition that there's a shared legal responsibility for mental health and well-being between the organisation and the individual, which I think that has been such a great recognition, because we, as I said, we have seen organisations just throwing self-care strategies at people. And, you know, meanwhile, they've got ridiculously high levels of work overload, bullying and harassment, all of these psychosocial risk factors. So now with the legislation, they need to reduce, they have to audit and identify and reduce psychosocial hazards as much as is practicable. They have to manage illness, which is typically your employee assistance programs or supporting people in getting the support they need. And the third prong is called promote flourishing, which is what are you doing proactively here? And for those people that are interested, this comes off a paper back in, 2014, I think, by Anthony LaMontagne. Some people might be familiar with his work in, I don't know if he was Monash or RMIT, but that model that he created has now been, I believe, taken up by the World Health Organization. I think the Victorian government have adopted it. And it's a really fantastic model when you're talking to organisations, if you are doing work in workplaces, that, you know, you can introduce them to if they're not even familiar with it. And it, for me, it's a great framework because it's like, yes, as I said before, recognising that, well, what's the role of the organisation here? Are there factors that might be impacting someone's mental ill health that they might need to, you know, address? Yes, we need to support around the managed illness, but then again, what are we doing to promote well-being in the workplace?
What can our organisations do better, whether it's workplaces or schools? You've mentioned that some of the overwhelming volume of information that's being provided to everyone, you know, whether it's a platform in an organisation or the volume of mindfulness articles that people are seeing online and et cetera, it can start to feel like it's that well-being washing that you reference just by volume, even if the intent is a genuine one to kind of say, hey, we've got these things in place. Sometimes it might feel like it's quite complicated in terms of what do I use. And I know, being a psychologist, the understanding that I have and that I share with many of my peers about what mindfulness is and how it can be applied is very different to what you're going to see online and in a 15-second TikTok video or you know, whatever other medium that people are reading. You know, some of these things seem like they're incredibly misinformed, or they're informed, but they don't tell the whole picture. They don't tell the context, and so they lose that capacity to talk about the nuance, you know, where so much of mindfulness is really being deliberate, really being present, understanding intent and why you're doing it. And you know, some of those things are lost in articles around just breathe, you know, just watch your breath. It's like, for what purpose though? If we don't know the purpose, you know, if it's symptom reduction, then we're kind of back in this new space of going, oh no, we could be reinforcing an idea that we don't want to be, which is I have to feel better to function, and life should always be comfortable. So it's a challenging one about how to do it. But I suppose my question is, what can our organizations do to mitigate against some of these, you know, wellness washing or the challenges that, you know, staff, students come in with their natural overwhelm of the information these days?
I think there's a lot they can do, and I probably won't have time to go through it all today, but I think whoever your internal person is, and we are seeing now in some of the major banks, chief mental health officer. It's actually a role now that's been created. CommBank, Westpac have a chief mental health officer. The person who's in that role, and I've heard a couple of interviews, if you're interested there, I think there's interviews on my colleague, Jason Van Shee. He's an orgs psychologist who has a podcast called Psych Health and Safety. And there's a couple of interviews in there, which I think would be very informative that people could listen to by these chief mental health officers. The challenge is in an organisation, as you'd know, in that role, you really do need to have, you know, you may not be strictly speaking a registered clinical psychologist, but you definitely need to have a clinical mental health background to start with, but you also need to have an organisational background. And it's tricky to find people that have got that combination, particularly the way that our training system's been set up. I mean, I was fortunate once I finished my doctorate, I did peer supervision with an org psych because I moved into working in organisations pretty quickly. But I'd give him supervision on ClinSight because he had no ClinSight, you know, because I think in those sorts of roles you need both. So what I'm saying is you need somebody internal that is solid enough to be able to sort the wheat from the chaff, particularly when you've got a multitude of providers coming to you. And as you've rightly said, everybody and their dog is on social media with some form of psychological strategy. And so you need someone internal that has a sophisticated knowledge that can create a strategy, a very rigorous strategy that ticks the box, but certainly does align with the legislation. So that's required. But then can also ensure that any providers that are being brought in are rigorous, have a level of evidence base behind what they're presenting. I think you're right. Hopefully they've got a strategy that doesn't just rely on one-off workshops, that there may be, you know, a series of, it's a longer program over time, maybe shorter. I've seen a lot of organisations do lunch and learns over a period of time, which I think can be helpful. The other thing just on the top of my mind, I'd like to take this opportunity, Nesh, to all Please. Of those people listening today, particularly as psychologists or mental health professionals, even if you've spent most of your career in the treatment space, I would encourage you to lean into this space, have a voice in the promotion and prevention, you know, get on social media if you feel that's your thing, but at least be out there, because I think in my experience and some of my ClinSight buddies haven't really done that. And I think even as psychologists, of course, we have strict rules around, you know, what we can and can't say out in the public. I've actually done quite a bit of media work, and I can tell you, you know, you can be criticised by putting yourself out there. But I think we do as a profession need to own this space. This is our space, and we need to be out there brave, being brave and having a voice in our community, because otherwise all of these other voices are crowding us out.
Look, it's such an important point, and I know that I can get nervous in public conversations like this. You know, we have to monitor our language. We've got to put in caveats. You know, it can be a frightening situation because of this, you know, looming fear of saying the wrong thing and then having an APRA notification, etc. At the same time, balancing that with saying, what is the value of having a voice and promoting psychology and trying to do so in good faith and in good spirit, but also sometimes saying what is tough, you know, and as being scientist practitioners, we should be trying to be objective in our views as much as possible. And obviously drawing from research does that, but we can also be objective from what we observe, so long as we put in the reasonable caveats. And an example might be that I've observed our industry afraid of speaking out, you know, because we're actually human first, we're psychologists second, or actually, you know, we're probably parents second and all the other bits and pieces before we do our role, which is being psychologists. But there's a real importance of a psychologist having a voice and trying to promote and be helpful. And it's easy to be critical, sure, and there's value in criticism as well.
Yes.
I think it's just important that we try and, you know, promote concepts, ideas, like what we're doing even at the moment, to be curious. When we get it wrong, stick our hand up.
Right.
But I think we've got a lot to say. You know, like here's a classic one that I don't think psychology has done well to date. And I'm only guessing, but I think by virtue of psychologists being kind, compassionate, gentle, very client focused, we can sometimes be gentle with our clients in making appointments. And so we can say things like, would you like to make another appointment? Which I get. That makes all the sense in the world, because we don't want to be forceful. You know, we want to be client led. At the same time, when I come back from a doctor's appointment, my wife says, what did the doctor say? When are you going back? What, you know, when do they want you back? What's the plan? And it would be odd if I said, the doctor kind of said, you know, do you want to come back?
Exactly.
And I think as a psychologist, part of my training or the conversation should be to say, hey guys, when we see the need for psychological support, let's actually try and put our compassion and our fear of being directive aside and overcome that and say, hey, my clinical opinion is that you'd benefit from weekly appointments. I know that Medicare only provides 10 per calendar year, but the research actually says that 10 sessions a week apart is superior to 10 sessions a fortnight apart, and that's superior to 10 sessions a month apart. So I just want to inform you at least what's being said, so that we've got maybe better momentum in the work that we do. Maybe that also leads to then self-efficacy, and we know the importance of that in overcoming challenges and in integrating what we talk about, et cetera. But, you know, I think our human nature gets in the way, but I think you're right. Let's have a voice. And look, if I'm wrong in that opinion, I want to hear another opinion. Say, hey, Nish, I think you haven't thought of that, or it could be improved by this, or in actual fact, the evidence has changed. But if we're doing it in good faith and we're not being prescriptive, I think we can have a good voice, like what I think the APS does, generally speaking, and many psychs do, and other, you know, peak bodies of psychology in Australia as well. But I think you're right. Let's have a voice. Let's say what is on our mind in a respectful and thoughtful, but also clinical way that is informed.
Yes, and I think, you know, where you can, and I know it's challenging, I like to keep abreast of the research. I receive the abstracts every Monday on PosPsych and other areas that I'm interested in. It's very difficult. There's so much research coming out. But, I mean, the key research, if we can reference that in terms of, as you rightly said, you know, the research tells us that having these, so it's not just your personal, it could be your clinical opinion, because that's still very valid.
Yes.
But I think where you can reference the research, I certainly would recommend that, even in a coaching context. And, you know, similarly to counselling, we have this ask, don't tell philosophy. But I think particularly as registered health professionals, that it's even a duty of care that we need to share what the research tells us in this space. And clearly it's the client then needs to have the autonomy to make the decision, which we know is important. But I think that one other thing I wanted to say, well, I've got this opportunity with this audience too, is I would love to see more psychologists, mental health professionals step into the space of coaching and coaching psychology. So right now we have an interesting phenomena happening globally, which is being referred to as the democratization of coaching, which is not in its true sense of the word, the true democratization, but what they're talking about is historically workplace coaching was only offered to senior executives, senior leaders, you know, and costly, But clearly the reasoning behind that is that they have, you know, there will be that ripple effect, and there's, you know, the impact that they can have on all the people around them. But these new tech platforms, of which I sit on the scientific advisory board for Coach Hub, which is one of a number of them, there's BetterUp, there's Ezra, there's a number of new ones just launched here in Australia now too. You know, they engage coaches. Now, in my background, you know, I've worked with and trained many people who are not psychologists. But in, I guess, in the training I was fortunate to do at Sydney Uni, and I taught there for 10 years, we had dedicated content around mental ill health identification and referral. So our approach is definitely, you know, being able to know when to refer, you know, understanding mental ill health and referring on. Whereas, as you'd know, there are a lot of coach training schools that believe that they don't need to even know that because they don't work with mental ill health, is in fact what I've been told when I've asked them, do you have content around mental ill health in your coaching training program? Oh, no, we don't need it because we only work with people in the normal population. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, but just look at the basic statistics on mental ill health. And of course, you're going to have people coming for coaching that are clinically distressed. And in fact, my doctoral research found that 52% of people coming for a coaching intervention had significantly higher levels of psychological distress on the brief symptom inventory. So I've known that for a long time, but I've also, I guess, realistically understood that you can't stop a, I don't know what the saying is, but the train's already left the station. There are numerous people out there that are not registered psychologists that want to work in this space. And I think, you know, if we just look at the waiting list for psychologists, now we can't do everything. You know, we do need people. We need teachers, which is why I've been working with teachers. We're not trying to turn them into counsellors, but we're equipping them on how to, you know, manage ill health. I'm not necessarily doing that. That's the realm of that mental health first aid, I guess, space, but also how to promote their own well-being and then how to promote the well-being of their students in that proactive space. But I have seen over the years that hesitation from psychologists in particular that have contacted me that have said, you know, I want to refer someone to you for coaching, Susie. And I sort of say to them, well, you could do it. And they go, oh, no, I'm a therapist. I go, okay, but you know, you could do it if you wanted to do it, you know. So I would love to see more people, not just psychologists, but broader mental health professionals. You can broaden your scope of practice because I personally, one of the reasons I moved into coaching too was I realised I worked in a psychiatric clinic and saw a lot of people that were very, very unwell down in the Illawarra in my early career, that I personally couldn't sit and do that sort of work all day, every day. It was really already in the early days taking a toll on me. And I then also realised, in combination with the fact that it wasn't really playing to my strengths, so I do have, you know, I guess even though I've been very anxious most of my life, Nesh, using all my anxiety management skills to push myself out of my comfort zone and get out there and speak. But I have got some strengths around, you know, building rapport, connecting with people from diverse audiences. My presentation skills have improved over the years. So, but I would just love to see more people with mental health professional backgrounds move into this. You know, so you could have a mix. Maybe you do, but you'd start to advertise, or, you know, I don't mean advertise, but let people know that you can work across the spectrum of mental ill health through to even performance or life design or, you know, so I'd love to see that.
Look, it's an important point in terms of moving from that illness model over to that wellness model. And this is where that, I suppose, executive coaching, sports psych, you know, staff supervision programs for NGOs and the like all fits. And it's interesting because I've certainly seen my fair share of clients coming in for, you know, quote unquote executive coaching. And I can certainly say quite confidently, they don't need time management time management supports. You know, they are human. And so what happens is human issues end up arising. It's just easier to see an executive coach than a psychologist at times.
That's so
and
true.
You know, it's important to be able to do that so that you've got a way in if you're in the wellness side. And we spend so much time on the illness side of saying, how do you get in? Well, easy, you go and see GP. But how do you do it if you're already doing well and you want to bolster that? But I think there's great opportunity for growth in the, in that area. And not only to be just led by psychologists, but your other mental health professionals as well. So, you know, thank you for raising that as well, because I think it's such an important point. And I know that we're very, very time limited today, but maybe I could just ask you a final question in terms of, many of our listeners would most likely like to find out more about this topic, you know, do their own reading, continue on this conversation. Where could they go to continue to learn in this space? Are there websites, are there particular texts that you might be able to refer to, books, articles, and the like? Where could you send our listeners?
Yeah, look, well, our website has a lot of free resources on the resource page. I've done a significant number of podcast interviews, Nesh, and I'm also just finalising my second series in positive psychology coaching, which has become my sweet spot, combining positive psychology and coaching psychology. And I've interviewed some really interesting people, a number of them coaching psychologists. And as I said, you know, watch your space. Here in Australia, we wrestled with whether we should try and, you know, move the interest group. There still is an existing coaching psychology interest group. There's also a positive psychology interest group I'd encourage people to join. Professor Lee Waters leads that here in Australia. But yes, so I have that podcast where they can hear about that. And I do think, given what's happened in the UK, we may revisit our stance on coaching psychology here in Australia. Yeah, lots of resources, lots of books. Sydney Uni, if you're interested in doing a master's in coaching psychology. I also sit on the faculty at the University of East London, where there's a master's of positive psychology and coaching psychology, and you can do that by distance ed. We also have a handout, I'm pretty sure it's on our resources page, for recommended further education. And so if you don't want to do a master's, there are some short courses that we'd also recommend. So you can definitely check that out on our website.
And what's the website URL?
Oh, sorry. It's the Positivity, it's a long one, thepositivityinstitute.com.au.
Wonderful, wonderful. Susie, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you today and really look at that whole sphere of both sides of the ball, where I think sometimes we do neglect part of that space. I like the concept of also giving ourselves more encouragement to have a voice. All topics are important. We're all human first, and giving people the opportunity to, you know, grow themselves so that they can also support their loved ones, that you know, who and what is important, that we started off with. So it was a great pleasure, and thank you so much, and I appreciate all the work that you continue to do and your contributions to date as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Nesh, and same to you for all the wonderful work you're doing in the community.